You're listening to the Physics Ed Podcast. For hundreds of ideas, free experiments and more, go to physicseducation.com.au. And now, here's your host, Ben Newsom.
Welcome to another Physics Ed Podcast. Glad to have you again for another chat around STEM. And today, we're hanging out with someone who is highly passionate about inspiring students for her passion in marine biodiversity. She is very, very good at helping students really understand how to do evidence-based research, and she is very, very passionate about making sure that our fisheries and aquaculture industry is sustainable and healthy. We're hanging out with Professor Kirsten Beckendorf from Southern Cross University, and today we're going to learn just how she thinks about how science should work and how she works with a whole bunch of different teams to make sure her research really makes the best benefit for us and the environment. Let's find out more.
This is the Physics Ed Podcast. We're all about science, ed tech and more. To see 100 fun free experiments you can do with your class, go to physicseducation.com.au. That's physics spelled F-I-Z-Z-I-C-S. And click 100 free experiments.
Hi Kirsten, welcome to the Physics Ed Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, look, thank you for coming along, especially during the peak of flood monitoring. It's a bit busy for you.
Yes, so it's a bit over a year post those significant floods in the Lismore area, and we're really trying to get out on country and collect data to see how these systems are actually recovering.
That's fascinating. So a long time ago, I did an undergraduate degree in environmental biology, so I've got a little bit of an inkling about where you're going with this, but I'm curious. That's not the only thing that you do with marine work. Hey, Kirsten, what do you do?
Yeah, what do I do? good question. So at the post-flood monitoring is actually really looking at the invertebrates in the sand. So we're looking at little things like worms, bivalves, crustaceans as bioindicators to test out the health of the system. But we're also looking at contaminants in the sediment. So we're looking at whether there's heavy metals and other things that might have come down in the flood. So that's one of the projects that we're looking at. But in addition to that, I'm really interested in looking at generally the health of seafood, how that contributes to human health, and how what we do in our natural environment impacts the health of and safety of the seafood that we eat. So just, I guess, trying to make everyone understand that there's a strong connection between the land and the sea, and what we do in these catchment areas above where we grow our seafood can actually get into the environment and impact both the safety and health of the seafood there as well. So that's my broad research program around, the health of the environment and the health of our seafood.
Well, what's interesting is as we have a chat, so timestamp this conversation, it's 2023 in the middle of the year, and a year after, actually a bit over a year since the Lismore floods, and you're looking at that flow-on effects. What's your guess about how long these effects might last, whether they're good, bad, or in between?
Yeah, it's interesting because the extent of the impact depends on not only the flood, I think, in that particular catchment, but how healthy the system was before the flood and the multiple stresses. So what else is going on in that particular estuarine system at the time? We're studying six different estuaries. One of those is in the National Park, the Sandon River. It's a lovely, pristine system. And we did find higher diversity in there and not a lot of evidence of flood impacts, straight after the flood compared to the other sites where upstream at our highest, so we're going up the estuary, we're not going into freshwater, but where the marine and freshwater are still mingling, those highest sites upstream tend to have really heavy layers of silt. And the first time we sampled some of those sites in Brunswick River and Richmond River, sinking, up to our chests in mud, it was just like swimming through this fine sediment of mud. And sampling with our cora, we could actually see layers of where the seagrass should have been, and sort of the compacted dead seagrasses. And we could also see sometimes these sort of red layers, which was where some of that terrestrial soil had sort of come in. So you could just see it when you were sampling. But as you move down towards the mouth of the estuary, the impacts aren't as great because the flushing with the ocean happens much more quickly. And so recovery at that end of the estuary seemed to be much faster. So I think the estuaries are starting to resettle, But I think we do still have ongoing persistent impacts in estuaries like the Richmond River, where there is a lot of sort of runoff from sugarcane and other industries on land. And of course, clearing of that riparian vegetation, which is a big problem.
Well, as I think about, we're talking about Australian mainland at this point. There's a lot of river systems.
Yeah.
There's a lot of estuaries. And that's a lot of sampling to do. How do you deal with that?
Well, I guess I can't possibly cover
all
the estuaries. So I'm working on the mid-north coast to the north coast of New South Wales. And, even getting up and down those six estuaries is a pretty big effort, particularly when some like the Clarence River is just a massive system. It's a really big river. The Department of Primary Industries is now looking at expanding this sampling further down the south coast and looking at other aspects of the environment, like the fish populations as well. Because one thing that we realise is that we don't have good baseline data. And that was one thing that surprised me. I couldn't look at flood impacts because we didn't have before data in most of these estuaries. In some of them, we do have some data. But, you know, there's usually just, you know, a few little patches of data 10 years ago, 8 years ago, and no sort of consistent sampling of monitoring. And it's tricky when you're dealing with shifting baselines. You don't know what's normal and what is, you know, what's the point of recovery? When can you say it's recovered if you don't actually have that preliminary or initial data? So yeah, there's need for more work. And it looks like the Department of Primary Industries Fisheries is definitely going to try and, you know, expand that to get more baseline for future.
That's really quite the project. I was actually thinking of just describing this. I mean, some people listening in would have definitely heard of Sydney Water Stream Watch. It's been around for many years and did a lot of stuff in freshwater environments, not so much estuarine and marine. Yeah. And a lot of baseline data gets collected by schools of different age groups and whatnot. Mm. And it's been going on for many years. Is this sort of an area that could grow into this, you know, some of the ecosystems that you're dealing with?
Yeah, definitely. I think there is the Streamwatch program where a lot of people are looking at macro invertebrates in streams. And with respect to the water quality data, often the data that's collected is just temperature, pH, salinity, those types of things, which I guess it's not necessarily picking up all of the impacts of nutrient runoff and, you know, the changes in pH are actually something that probably can be detected with respect to acid sulfate soils. So definitely something school groups can get involved in. But it changes day and night in the estuary as well, because you've got sort of these respiration
and forth
synthesis cycles. So yes. It's good to get night data as well. But yeah, I think turbidity is something that the school kids could definitely collect. That's where, you know, we think about a nice healthy system when we can see nice clear water. If you've got too much sediment in the layer, sediment in the water, it appears as quite turbid. And that can be measured quite easily with a tube. It's a turbidity tube, you know, pretty cheap to do. And I think pretty important to collect the sort of data that way. Collecting data on the organisms themselves, well, interesting, because we've been out in some mangroves looking at some options with the Goombangi ranges out there. And, you know, some things like the things that live in the sediment are really interesting, but, you know, whether you can identify them all back in the lab is a challenge. But one thing that we found is a good little indicator are the soldier crabs. You can see all the soldier crab holes and their activity on the top of the surface. But you can also do a core and you can kind of sieve them and the little soldier crabs run around. So you could sort of have fun picking out the soldier crabs and actually counting how many you get in a certain area in the sand.
Oh, definitely. You've actually tweaked a very distant memory of mine. So in late final year undergraduate, I spent a week in Jervis Bay and we were doing mark and recapture with red-fingered crab off the top of my head. And there was two others, a semaphore crab and one other, and my brain lets me go. I'm going back quite a few years. But I remember doing it and I was stunned about the sheer number of these things. Huge.
Yeah. And, you know, definitely they can be very dense and they're turning over the sediment. They're actually, you know, keeping it aerated. They're keeping the nutrients cycling through the system. And they're a sign of a good, healthy system, because one of the things that, you know, we've been looking at is this mangrove die-off in Boambi Creek, and the sediment's, you know, black and quite compacted and smelly and, you know, not nice. And, you know, the soldier crabs just aren't there. The crab and the you know, the crabs actually all of the crabs throughout that forest are just not there. So they're definitely an indicator that there's something going wrong in that particular forest. And yeah, it's good when you've got little critters that you can see. It's some of those bigger crabs with their sharp claws are not necessarily the ones that the kids are going to want to pick up, like the big mud crabs, but the little soldier crabs, they're really gentle and they're super cute. So yeah, definitely.
Oh, for sure.
We had to be looking at them.
We had to be really careful in your metaphors and frankly, oysters. As we're digging around. And actually, it was a really good example of, so we were students, you know, tertiary level, trying to do our job properly. Mm-hmm. But let's be honest, there was bias. I mean, if you had a marked crab and you could see it, guess what you were going to try and do?
Yep.
Which is a bit of a conversation. I mean, so as you design your projects, and these are real research projects, they're, you know, feeding towards, you know, the DPI to think about, you know, how they might manage catchments. How do you manage bias so it's done properly?
Yeah, well, it is all about standardizing the methods. And I think it's actually really important to, whenever you're sort of planning a new project, the first thing you've got to do is get out into the environment and observe what's possible and trial some things that might work. Because, yeah, when we first started the post-flood monitoring, we thought we might drop a grab off the boat and, you know, collect some sediment, apart from the fact that it wasn't safe. So there was OH&S issues with the size of our boat and the grab. And the grab wasn't grabbing consistently. You know, it depends on the coarseness of the sand. If you've got more shell grit or if you've got fine sediment, the whole fine sediment was just trickling through. But we wanted to sample that fine sediment because that was the flood impact. And so we changed to these hand corers, which is, you know, really low technology. They're just PVC pipe with a little plug on the top and, you know, drill it into the sand and pull that core up. So, you know, kind of simple methods that actually really worked because it's absolutely reliable. And we sort of set the depth that we want to sample at and do four transects and the three sort of depth levels. And you standardize that according to the height of the tide and various other things. So, yeah, it is about trialing things in the first instance, planning. So always those preliminary studies, I think, are really important. And then going with what works and what you know that you can repeat over time or over space or both, if that's what you're trying to do. So it's really repeatability, I think, that matters.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I was thinking about some of the work that gets done by high school teachers around the country. And we want to be able to emulate what gets done with biological programs. Yeah. I mean, if you're listening in, there should be certain buzzwords grabbing your head, like transect, bioindicator, and various other things. These things actually happen in the real world. And so as we design this, I mean, I guess the challenge is, I guess it's good that you mentioned WHS, you know, the safety aspect is a reality. And you're dealing with water.
Yeah.
It's kind of important with that. So when you do this sort of work, how much, when you say based on data, before you can make a decision that something's actually occurring in the environment, I mean, are you looking at a year, 2 years, multi-years before you go, yeah, this is specifically, it's within confidence limits that there is genuinely a problem?
Yeah, I guess it just depends on the study. But if I take my Wagulga Lake study for an example, there we did 10 surveys over a year's period, and we were sampling in different conditions. So after rain runoff events and dry events, and when the lake was closed to the open and when it was open to the ocean. It was very interesting to find that, for example, over 80% of the days, the bacterial levels in that lake exceeded, you know, Australian guidelines for safe swimming. 100% of the time, it exceeded safe guidelines for collecting shellfish. So I think when you've got those national guidelines to compare the data to, and that's where, you know, looking at nutrient levels, the bacterial levels are quite interesting. And again, something potentially that could be done with teachers and schools. You can get the plates that you can do the very standardized method for you know, counting fecal coliforms in these water samples. So it gives you some idea of, it's always good to have a comparison. Now, there have been studies, of course, that show that unless you're actually looking for human pathogens, they could have come from dogs or seabirds or other such things. So again, you need to observe what's going on in the environment. But if you're looking at a stormwater runoff and you're sampling sort of upstream and downstream of it, it could give you some sort of indication of what's going on there. So yeah, I guess in terms of how long you need to study, it depends on what you're trying to find and the level of natural variability. So what we're always trying to determine is what is that baseline, what's natural. And so you kind of need to get some sort of, you know, indication of whether it varies across the year in different seasons, and then see if we can actually detect an impact over and above that. And so when the big monitoring studies haven't been done, it's actually harder to know, and you're usually restricted by what's feasible. You know, what can you logistically do in this time frame? And we found that three sites and in Six Rivers was actually all we could do in a sampling period logistically, and even that's actually pretty hard work, to be honest. But you know, it's not just the getting out into the field and getting the samples, but when you've got those samples, you then need to process them. And so we're, you know, sorting through these samples in the microscope, and that takes months. And yeah, so you've got to kind of think what's feasible to do as well. And you're better off with less good quality data than, you know, a bigger data set that's compromised, or you don't finish, you know, you don't get through it. So yeah, it's another factor that you've got to put in.
Bite off what you can and chew as quickly as you can.
Absolutely.
It sounds very, I mean, it is, it's multidisciplinary. Mm. There's so many different levels. I mean, in just a couple of minutes, you move from microbiology after talking about hydrology, geology and everything else. It's difficult. So with the, in the world of tertiary land, I mean, you'd have to work across multiple faculties to be able to produce a large report. Or is this something that if you're working with Six Rivers, it's done within your own team?
Yeah, I mean, this one's done within my own team, but I am multidisciplinary. So I guess, you know, I started my undergraduate in biology, and I did a PhD that was biology and chemistry, although more natural products chemistry. It just happens that the skills I have in natural products chemistry also apply to looking for pesticides and things like that. Yeah. So I have an understanding of that. And yeah, over time, I've sort of come to realize that to really look at environmental health, you know, understanding, you know, these other components, nutrients and, you know, the sediment type and, you know, doing these metal analyses, all of those types of things are quite important. But some of these samples that we collect and then we contract out to the environmental analysis laboratory. So they're the experts on the machines that can produce some of those data. And then we need to be able to interpret and analyze the data. So yeah, I'm probably more multidisciplinary than a lot of people just because of the path that I've taken and the various interests that I have. Yeah. But in science, we can always collaborate. And I think you do get the best work done when you work as a collaborative team where people are, you know, really joining their different skill sets for the one purpose. You know, you've got the same outcome that you want, but everybody's contributing their expertise into that. And there's a lot of opportunity to do that in environmental science.
And speaking of the many disciplines, you've been very privileged to hang out with some amazing people with Science Technology Australia through the Superstars of STEM program. What's that been like?
Yeah, it's a fantastic program. I think just to, in one part, to see all of the other fantastic women in science in Australia. They're really inspiring just to hear what everybody's doing. And also, I think there's a good opportunity through those peer groups to sort of share experiences. And I'm probably one of the older in the group. So, you know, I've had this longer academic career. So it's kind of nice to sort of feedback my experiences and hope that that might help some of the others. We're just starting a mentoring program, and I'm really excited to start the mentoring. And I'm actually hoping that through that, not only can I gain personal advice, but that I can learn to become a better mentor as well. So, yeah, really appreciate the opportunities provided through that.
Oh, massively so. And I mean, there's a lot of time spent with mentoring for sure. I mean, I was sort of just wondering, as you were saying that, what are some of the challenges that juggling all the different things that are on your plate and being able to mentor as well at the same time?
Yeah, it is a challenge. And, you know, I've certainly been prioritizing mentoring of my HDR students, so higher degree research students. I have 10 PhD students at the moment, and I got a couple of undergraduate interns working in my lab as well. And I really love that sort of nexus of education and research and where we can sort of teach people to become better researchers. So I put a lot of focus into that. But it is hard to balance all of the things that we've got to do in our general day, but particularly in teaching term when, you know, the teaching of, I teach invertebrate life as my main unit, and I absolutely love it. I've always been inspired by invertebrates, and being able to inspire other students, you know, to love and appreciate invertebrates is really great, and learn taxonomy in the process. So, you know, I do kind of have to make all of my students aware that that's the time that I really need to be focusing in on the teaching side of things. And, you know, we juggle things around, but the reality is that the research never stops. You know, you can't predict when a new, you know, paper comes back that, you know, just needs some revisions to go back to the journal, and you've got to keep all of these things progressing simultaneously. So, yeah, let's just say I'm lucky that I'm an insomniac.
Yeah, I figure we sleep when we finally rest eventually. But I absolutely agree. Actually, I was just thinking there's something I'd like to sort of have a chat about. There'll be people listening here who teach from grade one, and there'll be people dealing with grade two through to 12, tertiary and whatnot. But no matter what, we're all science people who are going to listen to a podcast like this. So what makes a good scientist?
Interesting. I think a good scientist is really somebody who can think of a good, not only think of the good ideas, you know, ideas are cheap, they're all over the place, but it's actually thinking of a way that you can design an experiment to produce, you know, new knowledge that is actually sound. So it's there needs to be rigor in that process. So being able to design a rigorous experiment or a rigorous approach towards, you know, really supporting a hypothesis or, you know, discovering something new. And it is the follow through. So I guess if I think about the characteristics that I appreciate that I've got as a scientist, an analytical mind, so actually being able to analyze data, but also very observant. So being able to observe, I observe nature, and that inspires a lot of the sort of ideas that I come. But then, you know, following that through with the rigorous design and interpretation. So it takes a fair bit of commitment. And I don't know if that's some kind of that's question, but yeah.
No, you have, absolutely. And some of the things that I've heard echoed with other people before too. I mean, you're right. I mean, gosh, I have, and some people who know me definitely know I have a lot of ideas all the time. Doesn't mean I'm actually going to do them, but they're out there. But it does, it's the follow through and the rigor. I agree for sure. So if you were had a bunch of teachers or educators in front of you and you were imparting, here's how to go about said process to be able to produce at the end of their courses, scientists with some rigor, what would be some steps that you'd hope for them to at least encourage within their students?
I think the first step is to observe and question. So I think that's actually to encourage people to question, and then to think about the alternatives. You know, you're kind of thinking that might be the answer, but what are the alternatives? Because a good experiment is designed when you can actually rule out the alternatives. So how are you going to control that information so that you can actually demonstrate that, yeah, it is this and not that? So thinking about design, and I think that science is quite a creative process from that perspective. I guess teaching them the importance of numbers, like not to be scared of the maths. I see it as a really important tool that, you know, data is really important, being able to manage that data, being able to, you know, take care and check. I'm kind of one of those supervisors that likes to see the data sets of my students, because I can usually see if there's, you know, an error in the data there, do some preliminary sort of data analysis. But I guess one thing that I didn't mention about being an important scientist is also actually being able to communicate that science.
Yes.
So, you know, encouraging students to sort of think up their own, you know, observe, you know, nature or, you know, a problem that they're interested in exploring, come up with some questions, think about, you know, how they want to test that. And then, you know, being able to share that information with others is really important. So they mightn't have the equipment to do the full experiment, but, you know, thinking about those design elements, because as we move through our careers in science, we realize that, yeah, we don't have all the answers ourselves. It is, you know, there's a whole world out there of other people that you can collaborate with. But, you know, having a firm idea of how you want to achieve something is actually a really important first step that can, you know, get you the right people and link you up with the right equipment and whatever else to get there.
Oh, for sure. I've been involved in quite a few high school programs over the years. And one of the things that we like to put on the end of it, we have a chance, is some form of pitching thing to be able to say, imagine you're getting funding for X, Y, Z. Mm-hmm. And often the students will go another shade of pale thinking they have to actually do this. But I'm saying, like, at some point, you want to advocate on behalf of what you've just done, because it might actually benefit the community, because there's an idea, because that's actually the role, or the environment or whatever it is that you're doing. But you want to keep funding, be able to keep the research going, or you want to get, you know, this is really is a skill, and it does take some time.
Yeah.
But I'm glad that you mentioned that, because the communication side, it does take time to develop like every other discipline.
Mm.
But it does matter, and also it does bring rewards if you can do it.
Definitely. And just to put it out there, I guess I was pretty introverted as a kid. You know, I was a pretty shy type of student, and not outspoken, but I had ideas, and I really, you know, pushed myself through that sort of barrier of being able to, you know, stand up and speak out. And I think that it's one of those things that you just improve with practice. It's absolutely build confidence building. And sometimes you just got to put yourself in those uncomfortable positions and push through it. And it's absolutely worth it when you do.
Oh, fantastic. Absolutely. Now, there'll be some people here who would love to know just a bit more about what you're doing, especially with marine ecology, because there's a lot of it going on.
Mm-hmm.
And they might just be fascinated about what's been going on with the floods and what you've been learning. And so how would they get in touch?
Yeah, well, I guess I'm at Southern Cross University, so that's probably the easiest way to track me down, at the National Marine Science Centre, which is part of Southern Cross University. Certainly, you could find me. My email is my name, kirsten.benkendorf@scu.edu.au. So that's certainly one option for tracking me down. But yes, I guess easiest to contact by email.
Easy. And as normal, we'll put those links in the show notes. And I actually have been to the Marine Science Center years ago when I was wearing a different badge with CSIRO, a long time ago.
Yeah.
It's very, 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 very nice spot. And if you get a chance to go up to Northern New South Wales, it's worth checking it out for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a Solitary Islands Aquarium, which is open on the weekends and public holidays. And yeah, certainly, and school groups can also book tours to come in and see, you know, the Solitary Islands system, which shows off the East Australian current and the different subtropical and more temperate systems that we get along the coast here. So it's pretty nice.
Oh, for sure. And it's nice that you mentioned that. So those people listening overseas, yes, we did just say the EAC reference Finding Nemo. It's a real thing. actually, a good friend of mine was doing work with fisheries, and you probably know Professor David Booth out of UTS. He does a lot of work, and he's noticing that subtropical fish are turning up down in Sydney, which is rather odd because we're not subtropical, really.
And we definitely get Nemo overwintering here on the Solitary Islands now, which was, you know, we were kind of the southern limit of distribution, and they'd come down in warmer climates and not stay all year round. But yeah, definitely a lot of evidence that more species are coming down and persisting and breeding here as well. So things are changing, no doubt about it. But we're a really important little pocket, I think, a stepping stone for some of those more temperate systems.
And done with rigorous research, and the data is real because the data has been collected. It's the thing. This is what the evidence is. It shows what's happening.
Absolutely.
Oh, thank you very much for popping on. It's been a real pleasure.
No, my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
We hope you've been enjoying the Physics Ed podcast. We love making science make sense. Why don't you book us for a science show or workshop in your school? If you're outside of Australia, you can connect with us via a virtual excursion. See our website for more.
So I hope you enjoyed that chat with Professor Kirsten Beckendorf. I certainly did. And guess what? You can collaborate and connect with her. She really wants you to. If you love your marine science and you want to conserve it, protect it, and all that sort of thing, well worth reaching out to her on her email that she gave. And as usual, we do put those links in the show notes. Please reach out to her. And also go find out about her research portal. There'll be a link in there too. Her and her team have produced over 150 scientific papers, and it's still ongoing. There's a lot of work to be done with this work with influencing policies on water quality management, pesticide regulations, and all the work that's needed for keeping our seafood safe and healthy. So I hope you enjoyed this chat. I certainly did. And there are more coming up on the Physics Ed podcast. So guess what? You've been listening to me, Ben Newsom from Physics Education. This is the Physics Ed podcast, and I hope to catch you another time.
You've been listening to another Physics Ed podcast. We're excited about science. Subscribe to us on iTunes to download the next episode as soon as it's released. And don't forget, for hundreds of ideas, free experiments, our new Be Amazing book and more, go to physicseducation.com.au. That's physics spelled F-I-Z-Z-I-C-S.
This podcast is part of the Australian Educators Online Network.
aeon.net.au.